Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For years, U.S. intelligence officials have been warning that foreign adversaries are working to sow division within our nation by flooding us with mis- and disinformation and using social media to speed the spread. The German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy recently released a report illustrating that this isn't just a top-down national problem designed to influence federal policymakers and those inside the Beltway. This is happening in the states, in towns, and communities nationwide. The Alliance has issued a state-by-state report on these activities, which shows that adversaries like Russia, China, and Iran are refining their information tools and tactics to exacerbate divisions within the United States, to destabilize the country within, and weaken it on the world stage. The report says they, quote, understand that state and local governments and communities are foundational to the strength of American democracy. So they place much of their emphasis there, and in North Carolina, the Alliance reports, Russia, China, and Cuba have been working to amplify conspiracy theories and spread false, misleading, and polarizing narratives about Hurricane Helene relief efforts. To defend ourselves from these attacks, we must be able to recognize propaganda when we see it. So how difficult is that? What kind of impact are these efforts having on us? And can we stop it? For answers, we turn to two of the authors of this report. David Salvo is Managing Director of the Alliance for Securing Democracy, and Brett Schaefer is Senior Fellow for Media and Digital Disinformation for that organization. They are both in town to speak tomorrow at the World Affairs Council luncheon at noon at the Charlotte City Club, for which I believe there are still tickets available. And they join us for the hour. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Welcome. David, I'm going to start with you. And before we talk about the contents of this report, which are troubling at best, let's talk about for a moment about the German Marshall Fund of the United States. That's separate from the Marshall Plan.
Correct.
Which came about at the end of World War II to help rebuild Germany following the war. The initial funding for the German Marshall Fund that we're talking about today came from Germany, is that right?
It did. It came from the government of West Germany, essentially as a thank you for the Marshall Plan.
Why? What did they hope to achieve by funding you?
Well, this was, you know, at the height of the Cold War still, decades ago, and the hope was to have an organization in civil society that was dedicated to advancing the transatlantic relationship, the notion that Americans and Europeans are stronger and safer and more prosperous if they are united in alliance and partnerships. And there wasn't an organization at the time in civil society sort of representing both Americans and Europeans that was in service of that goal. So the West Germans decided, you know, we should set up an endowment to fund an organization that's headquartered in Washington but also has a European footprint, to do a lot of the research and policy work that shapes the future of the transatlantic relationship.
And the funding for this came along in 1972, which is not all that long ago. I remember it. But the Alliance for Securing Democracy is a subset of this. When did that start, Brett?
We were created in 2017. So okay. We were a direct result of the Russian interference campaign during the 2016 election. So we started as a bipartisan organization. Our original co-heads, one was a Democrat, one was a Republican. And the sort of guiding principle was we need to find bipartisan solutions to the issue of foreign interference because we clearly got caught flat-footed in 2016. We just didn't have a response. Nobody was paying attention, and especially in the arena of social media. So influence campaigns, information operations, nobody was looking at what the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians could possibly do on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram to influence Americans in often quite dangerous and damaging ways.
The German Marshall Fund's mission is to shape, as you've said, kind of the transatlantic relationship, partnership between the United States and Western Europe into the 21st century. And here we are in the middle of it. This is happening even as the Trump administration seems to be taking a different tack on all of this, turning its back on traditional alliances that have been around and saved the world from possible conflagrations since the end of World War II. And kind of ignoring Russia, sidling up to Russia and to China and to Iran in some cases. I know nuclear talks are either about to start or are underway. Not that that's a bad thing, but nonetheless, it's a different approach. Is your work now at odds with American foreign policy?
Well, it certainly is not considered a priority in this current administration to focus on foreign malign influence operations. I mean, every organ of the U.S. government that had been focusing on these issues has essentially been dismantled. So I suppose in that respect, yes, it is at odds, but I would argue very strongly that the work we do is in the national security interests of the United States. We should, regardless of your political persuasion, we are a now nonpartisan entity. You should be concerned that there are foreign security and intelligence services that are trying to surreptitiously affect the information you consume, the news you read, the view, shape the views you have. I mean, people should read whatever they want, but they should understand sort of where things are coming from. And very often these days, it's coming from foreign intelligence services.
And we know this. Average citizens who pay at least a little attention to the news know this. Therefore, our security infrastructure certainly knows this in Washington. The Trump administration certainly knows this. Why would they be dismantling the very structure apparatus that helps us understand what's going on and perhaps prevent what's going on or counter what's going on from foreign actors? Why would they do it?
It's a good question, because a lot of this was actually stood up during the first Trump administration. So when Dave talks about the multiple parts of the U.S. government that were tasked with countering foreign malign influence, again, many of those things were established during the first Trump administration. I think the problem is much of the Trump administration's view of countering foreign malign influence is sort of conflated with the Trump-Russia investigations. And so there's been a definite shift in the last few years of attacking work on mis- and disinformation. This is also in academia and civil society. And so looking at it as an effort to censor conservative voices. So they've been unable to disentangle those two things. And it's unfortunate, because we saw during this last election, the Iranians targeted the Trump campaign. The Iranians hacked the Trump campaign. They attempted to leak materials to U.S. news outlets. So there's direct evidence that our foreign adversaries are also attacking the right. So it's clearly short-sighted. But ultimately, I think the issue is this all goes back to the grievances that are felt among some in the Trump orbit about the Trump-Russia investigation of 2017-2018.
Well, you know, we pundits say that all of the guardrails that were in place in the first Trump administration are now gone. He knows now how to get around the system or work the system in his own particular way. Is this all coming from one person? Is this all the work of Donald Trump telling his people, this is what we will do, this is the approach we will take? Or are there people within the security apparatus who agree with that approach, that we were too far in the wrong in the opposite direction?
I think there's a flank or a wing of the Trump world that just truly believes that there was some sort of deep state conspiracy to denigrate President Trump and discredit his election.
But they are the deep state now. They run the apparatus.
Sure. Yeah. I think they would probably push back on that characterization. But the point is they truly believe, as Brett said, that there was some sort of attempt to essentially conflate foreign interference campaigns with Trump's legitimacy. And that's short-sighted, because as Brett said, there are foreign actors who are specifically trying to target the president. And I wish that they would have kept these important functions of government up and standing, because they're focused on very real threats.
Your organization's thrust is to revitalize or maintain democracies and revitalize democracies around the world. And the current administration seems to be embracing autocracies. not democracy. They've been turning their back on Germany and France and England and all of our traditional allies, including Canada. And they have a lot. They have a great deal of support from a large segment of the American voting population, and they have the support of almost the entire Republican Party. Have you already lost the battle?
I mean, I think this is a generational battle. I think thinking about this in terms of 2 to 4 year electoral cycles is probably a bit short-sighted, because I think the environment we have now is the byproduct of years and years of, you know, an information environment changing, of technology advancing, of civic education sort of being, you know, dismantled across the country. So this confluence of factors has, I think, contributed to an environment where there's also, you know, economic and real like lives and livelihood aspects to why people have sort of lost faith in democracy. Mm-hmm. So all that together, I think, has created this environment now where people are asking questions like, what has democracy really done to improve my life? And, you know,
how about everything?
What's that?
How about everything?
Yeah. How about everything? Right. That's a good response. But people don't believe it when they, you know, can't buy groceries at the grocery store, for example. And so I think it's important for us to have a little bit of empathy, at least for the reasons why, you know, an average American might be like, well, I don't care if, you know, I have a democratically elected leader or an autocrat. I just want to be able to, you know, get on with my life. Mm. But it's incumbent on us and civil society and those national political leaders who, you know, still care that we have a healthy, vibrant democracy to make the case that, look, your lives are impacted by this.
Let me ask you this. From two people that study democracies around the world and aid in strengthening democracies around the world, do we still have one in this country? I'm asking.
It's on shakier ground than I think it's ever been, at least in our lifetimes. So there are definite warning signs right now, and there are things happening.
What are those warning signs?
Well, I think the attacks on civil society, the attacks on academic institutions, the attacks on law firms, I mean, these are things that would have been, they are unprecedented. They would have been just sort of impossible to envision even 10 years ago.
Right.
And so once you start going after some of these pillars of democratic society, you know, you start on this slippery slope. Dave and I both lived in Russia. I lived in Hungary. We've seen what it is to live in the sort of new age of autocracy. And I think the problem for a lot of people is that what we're seeing right now on the streets doesn't feel like an autocracy, because we're used to the movies and there's not police forces in the street and your rights are not being actively trampled on in the way that we would sort of envision them being trampled on going back to the sort of Nazi period, right? And so it is tough, I think, for many Americans to see the more subtle ways that things are being undermined unless it directly is attacking them. And this is what you feel in Hungary or in Russia. You know, you can go out, you can have a great night out, and if you are not politically active, you're fine. You can live your life. But these slow efforts to kind of chip away at the pillars of democracy eventually lead you to a very bad place. And so I think we are seeing at least some efforts to start chiseling away at those things in ways that are really concerning.
And having lived in those two countries, Russia and Hungary, where autocracy is in full force, is the switch over here from what we have traditionally thought to be American democratic ideals to more autocratic approach, is it happening more quickly than it did in Hungary? Is it happening more quickly than we imagined it could or would or should?
It's definitely happened more quickly than we saw in Hungary. I think also probably Russia. I mean, in Hungary, we saw a gradual decline over 10 years to get to the point where they are now. And here, we've seen much of this happen within 3 or 4 months.
Wow. We have to take a break. David Salva's with us, and Brett Schaefer, both with the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy. We'll talk about the study that they conducted that talked about foreign actors and their bad influence in America when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with David Salvo, Managing Director, and Brett Schaefer, Senior Fellow for Media and Digital Disinformation with the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy. They'll be speaking tomorrow at noon at the Charlotte City Club as part of the World Affairs Council luncheon, for which there are tickets, I believe, still available. Among the values of the German Marshall Fund are to, quote, further the fundamental democratic principles of individual and opposition rights, rule of law, free and fair elections, protections for marginalized communities, and freedoms of expression, religion, and the media. All of these are being tested right now in this country. Is that because of the foreign influence that has been seeping in undetected or even detected for years and accelerated by the advent of social media? Or is it that a sizable chunk of the American voting population has simply changed sides, turned to a different direction?
I think the foreign actor threat is an accelerant to conditions that already exist in our society. And, you know, that's both a disengagement from civic life. It's the fragmentation of the information space through these social media platforms. It's the fact that people get their news from sources online that they don't know essentially the origin or the provenance of that content. So there are a lot of factors that contribute to this, but the foreign actor threat has really seized on this environment and amplified this sort of information morass that we live in. Significantly. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the crux of the issue.
Brett, you're in charge of media and digital disinformation, and most of this disinformation, well, maybe not most of it, but a lot of it is coming from outside. But all of this, what's happening right now is reminiscent of Pogo, the comic strip in the 50s, in which Pogo says, "We have met the enemy, and he is us." Is the greater concern interference from outside telling us lies about ourselves and we buying into that? Or are we the enemy? Is the enemy within?
Foreign disinformation campaigns cannot work unless they're given oxygen by domestic conditions. So they only work when they're able to seize upon these real grievances that exist in society. The Russians cannot implant a narrative into U.S. society and have it grow without there being conditions for that allow it to grow. So I think ultimately the responsibility for this lies on all of us. Now, yes, they certainly make it worse. They can kind of redirect fires. They can especially amplify things in moment of crisis that make things particularly dangerous. But none of this would work if we weren't a little bit frail in terms of our internal politics, in terms of our civic society. So I think ultimately the responsibility lies with us.
I'm sure that every country's enemies have historically tried to tamper with and interfere with that country. So I'm just curious what we do. Do we do the same thing that we're talking about here that Russia, China, Iran, Cuba do to us?
I'm glad you asked, because when you ask that question to the countries you just mentioned, they deny vociferously that they interfere mm-hmm. in democracies. I think it's important for us to acknowledge we did this activity in spades at the height of the Cold War. I mean, our whole U.S. intelligence apparatus was designed to interfere in other countries' internal politics. And when we did that, it very frequently backfired spectacularly and caused a lot of geopolitical misery for U.S. national interests. And I think we've learned from that, and we don't wage those sorts of massive interference campaigns like we did back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. But in terms of, say, manipulating the digital environment for our own ends, when we do that, I think we do this in small and isolated incidents now, and we do it very poorly. Because it's hard to penetrate autocratic information environments, firstly. Secondly, we're just not very good at it. And thirdly, we get caught, and when we do, we cede the moral high ground, we're embarrassed, and our impact is negligible. And, you know, Brett's got a good example from the Philippines that sort of illustrates why when we do this, we do it poorly.
Yeah, I mean, we ran a campaign that was caught and exposed by our own media. where we were effectively trying to tell Filipinos not to take Chinese-made COVID vaccines. So this is at the height of the pandemic. There was an influence campaign run by a contractor that was associated with the Department of Defense that was inserting these messages into sort of Filipino social networks, trying to denigrate Chinese-made vaccines, saying they're not safe and all of these things. That's exactly what the Chinese were doing to us at the time. And we had called them out on it. And we said this was particularly egregious because you are harming public health, you're harming individual people's lives. And to find that we were doing the same thing was obviously concerning. And again, when it was exposed in the media, it really undercut our moral high ground, especially with our European allies.
So are you saying that we don't do that anymore, or you're certain that we don't do that anymore, or you think that we don't do that anymore? Where do we stand?
So we clearly still do it in isolated cases. And it appears largely, though, that at times these are organs of the U.S. government or, again, contractors who are going a little bit rogue. I don't think there is a systematic approach within the U.S. government to run malign influence campaigns in other countries.
So clearly, from what you said, we don't do it well, and we are caught out on it by these more authoritarian regimes around the world, which begs this question. Are democracies more susceptible to this kind of manipulation? And if so, why?
Yes, we are, because our information environments are open and transparent. Our democratic institutions and processes are public and transparent. So all of our pressure points, all of our vulnerabilities, all of the points of tension and conflict in our society are wide open for our adversaries to exploit. We are very knowable because we are a democracy. Mm-hmm. So our strengths, and I truly believe that those are strengths, they are vulnerabilities in this particular facet that our adversaries exploit to their advantage.
Clearly, it's easier to do this now with social media. We don't have three television networks controlling all the news and five newspapers, and newspapers have gone through their own hell in recent years. So it's clearly easier to do it now, but it's also, it seems to me, easier to not know that it's going on now because there are no gatekeepers.
Well, there are no gatekeepers, and what the internet also allows is for anonymity. So you can be sitting in St. Petersburg, Russia. You can set up an account online that says you're a middle-aged woman in Charlotte. And so immediately you're part of a social conversation that 50 years ago for a Russian intelligence agent would have cost a lot of money. You would have had to have perfect English skills to try to insinuate yourself into American conversation to try to undermine those conversations. Now it is exceptionally easy at scale, especially with artificial intelligence, for them to present themselves as American citizens or American news outlets.
Is that what you mean by foreign state-sponsored actors in countries like Russia, Cuba, Iran, et cetera, using information manipulation intertwined with what you call authentic domestic networks? What are these authentic networks? Facebook?
Sure. I mean, it's organic conversation that's happening on social media platforms every day. I mean, Americans have their own beliefs and views on issues, and they engage on these social networks. What the inauthentic part of what's happening is the foreign actors then insert themselves into this debate, mask who they actually are, and try to either generate conflict or amplify conflict and do it at scale so that they bring more Americans into the public debate and make these issues even more contentious between us.
There's also been an evolution in information operations since even 2016. In 2016, what we saw were Russians in St. Petersburg at the Internet Research Agency, their troll factory, creating accounts presenting themselves as Americans. Now, the social media companies got pretty good at spotting those because there are technical signatures there that don't make sense. So what they've started doing is trying to launder their information through real Americans, covertly in many cases. So before the election.
So the real Americans don't know that they're participating?
These are often unwitting Americans. So the classic case was before the last election, there was a company that was stood up in Tennessee called Tenet Media. It had hired six of the biggest podcasters on the political right. It was determined that all of the money supporting Tenet Media was coming from Russia. These podcasters didn't know it. The people running this network did. And so you had these big podcasters who had million-plus viewership, listenership, who were effectively, unwittingly running an influence campaign for Russia.
Do they know it now?
They know it now because there was
Have they changed their behavior?
They have not. I mean, they definitely disassociated themselves from this particular company, but they're still doing their partisan act, which is why they were recruited in the first place.
Did they do this before social media, these countries that are trying to change the political climate in America? Did they do it before? How did they do it without social media?
Well, it took a lot of money and a lot of resources, and it took skill. So you look at the classic intelligence operations of the 70s and 80s. This required a large nation-state-sized budget and real expertise to try to integrate themselves into American conversations. Now it costs almost nothing, and it is incredibly easy. And again, they can do it at scale. So they can be in every conversation they need to be in with very little resources.
And in a democracy where you're liable not to shut down these social media platforms, you're going to let them do what they do. Is there any defense?
There are defenses. And the social media companies had gotten much better at detecting what they call coordinated inauthentic behavior. So they were worried less about the specific narratives and more about the actors and the behaviors they were using. So they could identify when, okay, this appears to be an inauthentic campaign here. These accounts that say they're in South Carolina or North Carolina, we're seeing them post at times that doesn't seem to be natural. They're all sort of posting at business hours in Russia or China. And so they got pretty good at detecting that kind of activity. Unfortunately, many of the social media companies have drawn down their teams trying to combat these kind of activities. And so—
Why would they do that?
Well—
Money?
Politics.
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 Well, talk to me about the politics of that. Why? What political party, Republican, Democrat, Independent, Green, whatever, would want them to not police bad actors on the internet who are interfering with American domestic policy?
Well, again, there's this narrative that any attempt to unmask this coordinated and authentic behavior has sort of targeted authentic conservative conversations in the United States. We, as an organization, have been caught up in that narrative as well, unjustifiably, I would say. But, you know, there's this attitude that the entire sort of mis- and disinformation research community is sort of, including at that time, the social media platforms themselves, was biased against conservatives. So all this notion about sort of masking and taking down Russian and Chinese and Iranian information operations was really an attempt to censor conservative voices in the United States. And that, unfortunately, has influenced the social media companies themselves to change their policies and procedures to essentially say, you know what, we're just not really going to do this at all.
So I was reading an article yesterday from CNN, and it wasn't dated, so I don't know how long ago this happened, but they reported that Finland is winning the war against fake news, a war that they launched in 2014. And CNN says that what they've learned can be valuable to other Western democracies. Do you know what they're doing?
Well, in a lot of those Nordic and Baltic countries, there's massive civic education campaigns to help the citizenry understand what the threats are, where they're coming from, to teach media literacy skills, to teach it in schools from a young age. You know, things that we frankly don't do at scale in the United States. But there's also an advantage that countries like Finland has. And that those countries have this advantage that they've been living next to this threat for decades. They understand it very deeply.
Yeah.
It's a more homogenous society. So it's, you know, there aren't the same sort of factions that exist here in the United States. And all that helps, I think, create more of an inoculation in a society like Finland.
Finland, as you mentioned, is a homogeneous country. Most people who are there are genetically Finns. I mean, they've been there for decades, centuries, and they rank at the top of almost every index that we keep around the world in terms of happiness and press freedom and gender equality and social justice and transparency and education. And they have a long tradition that we no longer have in this country of reading. Their population is 5.5 million people. They borrow close to 68 million books a year. They read. They're informed. What we read are these little headlines, clickbait headlines, on our phones. How dangerous is that to a survival of any democracy anywhere?
Yeah, the way we consume news now is really problematic. And this is across the board. This is not one political party, because as you said, for the most part, people are consuming news by scrolling through headlines. They're not even getting into the stories themselves. Right. And so oftentimes the story itself is fine and gets it right. The headline, though, will be sensationalized because they're looking for a click. And so you are getting a populace that is effectively having their sense of reality dictated by what an algorithm is feeding them and right. not even what a journalist is producing, because they are only seeing these memes, these very sort of rapid clicks of essentially doom scrolling through the political news of the day. And so the depth of knowledge is obviously decreasing because people are not sitting down and reading the Sunday paper from front to back. They're seeing a bunch of headlines that are also bombarding them at all times of day and are specifically targeted to them based on their political views and their clicks.
They don't trust the New York Times, the Washington Post. They don't trust the major network television newscasts anymore. They don't trust anything but Fox News on one side, MSNBC on the other. Why? And what is the effect of that? And who is driving that, telling people that you shouldn't trust these legacy media organizations, including us, NPR?
Well, I think even the legacy media organizations you highlighted there, the sort of Fox News, MSNBC split, that's even becoming a little archaic. Now, the younger generation, they're getting their news from TikTok influencers. So these aren't even trained journalists at any level. And so increasingly, you are seeing people getting their news from influencers. Yeah. Who do not have journalistic training at any level. It's not just that they're biased or, you know, clearly have support for one party over the other. These are people who are lifestyle influencers who talk about politics.
What I'm hearing you say is that we're doomed.
Well, we try to have a slightly more optimistic approach to that, but I do get a little bit depressed at times with the work we do, because it does seem that we are fighting against forces that are a little bit out of our control here.
Are all Western, I guess all Western democracies are being attacked in this way from foreign actors who would like to see democracies fail for whatever reason. Are other countries taking this more seriously than we are? And if so, what are they doing that we are not?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our Western allies, our European allies, and Canada even, are taking this quite seriously. They are organized as governments to track and monitor threats, but also to develop policy responses to close vulnerabilities to them. And, you know, as you've mentioned, Finland, a lot of our Northern European countries have really made concerted efforts to educate society about why this is a problem for them individually and for the health of their countries.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to ask you to rate us on a sliding scale of 1 to 10, how we're doing in comparison to other countries and other things that we'll talk about in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're speaking with members of the World Affairs Council, the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy, who will be speaking at the World Affairs Council tomorrow. David Szabo is the managing director, and Brett Schaefer is a senior fellow for, they're both senior fellows, but Brett is senior fellow for media and digital disinformation. And we were talking about the fact that this happens in all Western democracies, this flood of disinformation and bad actors flooding the market with incorrect information. How do we rank in terms of what other countries are doing? Because you say other countries are doing it better than we are. They're fighting it better than we are. They're taking it more seriously. Where would you rank us on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best at this, 0 being the worst?
I think we need to look at this from a pre-January 2025 perspective and a post-January 2025 perspective, because before we were actually doing fairly well. Brett and I were talking about what number we would assign. A 5 feels pretty good, like a pretty good score. Pre-January 2025, we had government entities that had been stood up to track and monitor these threats and even to communicate with mm-hmm. the American public about what they were seeing in the context of an election campaign. And we had a fairly robust civil society response organizations like ours, and there were many of us that were set up to track this activity and also sort of do awareness raising across the country. And social media platforms, at least maybe not immediately prior to the election, but in a couple, 2 to 4 years before that, were, as Brett mentioned earlier, sort of engaged in trying to take down coordinated and authentic behavior. Now all that's gone. All of it's gone. On the government side, it's gone. On the social media side, it's gone. And civil society is being targeted and attacked. So we're probably looking at a one right now.
So you have a regime in place at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue that is cozying up to the very people that are spreading this, the very nations that are spreading this disinformation, Russia, China, Iran, Cuba, to a certain degree. You've had a track record now of Donald Trump in the first administration and now in the second, sidling up to authoritarians and backing away and turning his back on our traditional allies. The people who are spreading this disinformation throughout social media in democracies around the world are doing it because they don't want democracies to succeed. Does the current administration?
I mean, I think there are people in the current administration, probably the president himself, who admire autocrats because of the power that they concentrate in their countries and their respective societies. And I think there's something that is attractive to those senior folks in this administration. If democracy is not, if it doesn't advance their own political interests, then it's not as important. But there are also their voting constituency believes that the other side is antithetical to democracy itself, that it's, this sort of big government attempt to suppress society and control society. So we're operating from completely different narratives and completely
but
different.
But the people on the other side that they complain about, right, with some justification, are not going after Harvard University and shutting down research programs that have made us the leader in the entire world on scientific research. They're not going after things that are going to destabilize the world economy. They're not going after law firms. They're not rounding up people and denying them due process. That is not democracy. That is not American. And everybody that I've asked this question of sugarcoats the pill. At what point are people like you who watch this around the world going to say what they're seeing here in America for what it is?
Well, it is straight out of the authoritarian playbook. I mean, we've talked about how this happens in countries like Russia and Hungary. They have learned from those experiences abroad. This is unquestionably adapted to an American environment, but it is learning from what has happened in Russia and Hungary. I mean, even the rubber stamping of Congress, for example. I think back to my time in Russia, the Russian State Duma, the lower house of parliament, was essentially just a rubber stamp for Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin. And, you see a lot of the checks and balances being eroded here in the United States too, where, representatives are turning a blind eye.
All of them.
So, it is clearly drawn from this authoritarian playbook.
So the actors who are working to destabilize Western democracies through the things that you study with the Alliance for Securing Democracy, they're working against election success in all of the Western democracies, including our own. But our elections are not centrally controlled. They are controlled in hundreds of counties and tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of precincts around the country. Does it make it more difficult for these bad actors to influence our elections?
In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. I mean, it is harder to run a single campaign that could somehow influence an election, or particularly in some way, if you're talking about actually having a cyber intrusion into an election infrastructure and having that sort of destabilize the entire election. In other ways, it makes it easier for them on the information front to try to insert or sort of seed social media platforms with supposed evidence of fraud or other sort of illicit or illegal activity, because Americans do not understand how elections are run in states that are not their own, if they even understand how elections are run in their own state. And this goes to election officials. We're often on calls with election officials where we're talking about some of the rumors, some of the conspiracy theories that we're seeing online. And an election official in one state would say, we've got to counter this. This is just not how it works here. And then somebody in another state says, wait, 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 wait. this is legal in Wisconsin and it's not legal. And so the complexity of the many different ways in which we run elections here means that you often see on social media a meme or whatever posted by a foreign or domestic that will say, look, we found this evidence of fraud, without understanding in that particular context that that is entirely illegal. That's just the way it's run. Like, you can register to vote on election day in Wisconsin, and you can't in many other states. So you often see data that is misrepresented. So it creates a lot of opportunity for bad actors to try to influence people because of a lack of understanding of how elections work.
And when we think about these bad actors from other countries trying to come in here and influence our election, we tend to think that they're trying to go after the presidential election because they want one side or the other to win. But your report indicates that our adversaries, quote, understand that state and local governments and communities are foundational to the strength of American democracy. And that means they are targets for destabilization. Targeting 50 states and the towns and cities in them seems like an enormous, perhaps almost impossible task. Are there certain areas of the country, though, that they focus on more than others? And if so, why?
Sure. Well, I mean, they're smart enough to see polls and they understand what a swing state is. So in big national elections, we see them disproportionately targeting swing states. But they also target state and local elections that they care about, where they have a vested interest. So we see the Chinese, for example, targeting down ballot races where they have a business interest, or where there's a local politician who is particularly friendly or not friendly towards the CCP. And so we see
that's
them
the communist, Chinese Communist Party.
Correct. So we see them targeting elections that they care about. I mean, again, they've got to be strategic. They don't care about and they don't have the resources to get involved in every single election across the U.S. So they pick and choose their battles.
But will they with artificial intelligence?
That has allowed them to scale up their operations. Okay. It's an assembly line now. So what used to take an entire troll factory in St. Petersburg to run an operation, you can do that with far less people. Or if you had that amount of people, you could triple your outputs. So it is significantly easier for them to target more elections. Their English is going to be perfect because they can just run everything through ChatGPT. And so this has really allowed for, in some ways, a democratization of disinformation. You don't even need to be the Russian government. You can be a non-state actor who cares about interfering in democracy, and you can scale up your operation because of AI.
You can be a big corporation
right
in China. You did this 50-state report. So let's look at the two states that we broadcast to, North and South Carolina, and what your report uncovered about activities here. First, North Carolina. Your report looked at activity here in September and October of last year leading up to the election. You say that Russia, China, and Cuba are the threat actors here with the objective of dividing and undermining through campaigns of smearing and polarization. How did those efforts manifest themselves in October and September of last year, or whatever it was, September and October of last year?
Well, this was after Hurricane Helene.
Okay.
And so there was, of course, a lot of commentary on social media criticizing FEMA's response, most of that driven by domestic players. But what we saw foreign adversaries do is, in some cases, just amplifying that criticism, but in other cases, sort of redirecting the conversation around their issue set. So you saw Russia, for example, saying the reason that people are not receiving the response or the money that they think they should receive from FEMA is because that money has all been redirected to Ukraine. You saw the Iranians say that it's all been directed to Israel. And so you saw the Chinese saying that's all been redirected for Taiwan. And so it's kind of repackaging the narratives that are existing organically to undermine geopolitical issues they care about. But the secondary thing is they just like to see chaos in some cases. So if there is a particularly partisan activity in the United States, they'll just lean into that. They'll be sort of bandwagon followers of that. And they're parasitic in some ways. So whatever is happening domestically that is divisive, they'll lean into that. They'll amplify it. They'll just give it more oxygen.
So when it came to all this disinformation being spread about FEMA and the fact that FEMA was only giving out $750 for quick serious needs assistance, which was not true, that FEMA had diverted all of its funds to the border, which was not true. Are these pieces of disinformation being spread just through chat groups and on Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and things like that? or are they being spread mainly by people who read it, believe it, and spread it to their friends and neighbors?
Well, unless real Americans believe it and spread it to their neighbors, the influence campaign is not successful. So ultimately, a successful influence campaign is when you get real Americans to do the bidding for you. So you see the Russians trying to seed these certain narratives, so they get picked up by influencers who have an authentic American constituency. And so the real damage happens probably offline in the way it's always happened, around the dinner table, at a bar. But you see most of these efforts obviously happening online. So that's why it's always difficult to track influence. And we're often asked, you know, what was the effect of this? Like, how do you gauge the impact of Russia or China's influence campaign? And I can never answer that question because, yes, we can look at social media metrics. We can see how many clicks, how many views. But we don't know is if they've influenced a particularly influential American who then has picked up that narrative and took it upon themselves to spread it.
And when successful, these efforts can actually hamper these recovery efforts. They can stall them out. They can cause things to be far worse than they would be otherwise. I would imagine that your organization would suggest to people that when they find a piece of information that they find troubling or interesting or even possibly hopeful, they should check the source. But how?
This is the challenge because, of course, we see foreign adversaries creating faux local news outlets that present themselves as being local, authentic American outlets. And unless you're skilled at open source intelligence, you're not going to be able to know that the Raleigh Times, for example, is actually connected to a Dubai-based factory that's pumping out all of this faux local news garbage called sort of pink slime content. And so it is really, really challenging in the current information environment for anyone to understand the provenance of information.
Your report on South Carolina came, I think, prior to the last fall's election. It came much earlier. In fact, each state that you've, of the 50 states, each state is being looked at in a slightly different time frame. What did you find in South Carolina?
The case that we highlighted in South Carolina was a Russian-linked troll factory in Ghana that was presenting themselves again as American, often as Black Americans, to try to stoke racial division. So we saw them presenting themselves as being, local American citizens concerned about race-related issues. I mean, this was around the time of the George Floyd protests. And that's been a constant in Russian influence campaigns for 60 years. They understand our pressure points. So they know we have a problem with race and racism. And so we saw actually around 2019, 2020, the Russians outsourced some of their influence campaigns to Africa. This was partly to obfuscate where the information campaign was coming from because the social media companies had gotten better. So all of a sudden you see IP addresses from Africa, not from Russia, it doesn't raise the same alarm bells. So they'd outsourced this campaign to Ghana. Many of these individuals were presenting themselves as local South Carolinians, and they were talking about the same issues that Americans were talking about at the time, NFL protests. But they were doing it in a way that was trying to exacerbate the situation.
If the federal government is not taking this information seriously, if they've dismantled the apparatus that notices what you're noticing through your report, do the state governments take it seriously? Or are they equipped? Are they capable of taking it seriously?
They are notoriously, I think, under-resourced and have a lot of other competing priorities. This is not like a, I think this is more on the agenda than it used to be, but there are only so many people, there are only so many resources to address these problems. And again, in the absence of like a massive sort of civic education campaign to help the populace understand what they're dealing with, you know, it's difficult. It's really difficult.
Brett, your report says that much of the onus of combating these bad actors is on us. You say every citizen is a potential entry point for an adversary and Americans need to act like it. I take it that means that any of us can read a false story, including me, and we can talk about it and spread that disinformation to somebody else. So if we're all potential spreaders of disinformation, how should we act? What should we do?
I mean, we are the problem and we are the solution, right? And I think your point is very valid that, look, Mike, you obviously have an outsized influence. So if you somehow picked up a false narrative online, spread it on your show, it's pretty obvious how that works. But we are all now information producers as well as consumers because of social media. So you can be, you know, your cousin in Texas who's on Facebook all day and actively pushing out messages and be just as influential in your circle as somebody in the traditional media. So we all have the responsibility to cross-check information.
Brett Schaefer is Senior Fellow for Media and Digital Disinformation, and David Salvo is a Senior Fellow and Managing Director of the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy. They've done a 50-state look at disinformation tactics being used by outside bad actors and their influence on American politics and American society. It is alarming at best. Thank you both for the hour.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.